I'm Roman Mars, host of 99% Invisible. I love the book, The Power Broker, the epic biography of former New York City planner Robert Moses. So I'm breaking it down 100 pages at a time and talking to special guests about why this book matters, like Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I actually think if it wasn't for Robert Moses, I probably wouldn't have run for Congress.
Listen to 99% Invisible's breakdown of The Power Broker every month on the 99% Invisible podcast feed.
Hi, I'm LeVar Burton, and this is LeVar Burton Reads. In every episode, I handpick a different piece of short fiction and read it to you. The only thing these stories have in common is that I love them, and I hope you will too. You know, sometimes I want a short story to just transport me, to fully immerse me in another time or place, to give me a whole set of characters who feel so real that they become my friends, family, my enemies, in just a few thousand words. And Luis Alberto Urrea can construct a short story that will do exactly that. This one is from his collection entitled The Water Museum. And Luis is going to take us to the town of El Rosario in Sinaloa, Mexico. It was historically a mining town, rich in silver and gold, and has a beautifully Baroque church with an altar covered in gold leaf that was rebuilt after the original structure was on the verge of collapse. Luis's father is from the town, and Luis has come back to it again and again in his writing, sometimes calling it Tres Camarones. This version of the town is all his own. And he's given El Rosario a graffiti artist in residence, Mr. Mendoza, who acts as the townspeople's conscience and calls them out in their hypocrisy and wrongdoing. Luis writes wonderful and warm prose, and somehow he always gives us the perfect level of detail so that each of his characters is immediately familiar to us. If you've never encountered his writing, you're in for a treat. Luis Alberto Urrea is the author of 17 books, and he's been a Pulitzer Prize finalist for nonfiction, a member of the Latino Literature Hall of Fame, and a Guggenheim Fellow. So there. His most recent novel is called Goodnight Irene, the story of a woman who joins the Red Cross during World War II and finds herself on the front lines. The story is inspired by Luis's own mother, who worked as a donut dolly, serving coffee and donuts right at the heart of the action. And now, if you're ready, let's get into today's story. Let's take a deep breath. And begin. Mr. Mendoza's Paintbrush by Luis Alberto Urrea. When I remember my village, I remember the color green. A green that is rich, perhaps too rich, and almost bubbling with humidity and the smell of mangoes. I remember heat, the sweet sweat of young girls that collected on my upper lip as we kissed behind the dance stand in the town square. I remember days of nothing and rainstorms, dreaming of making love while walking around the plazuela, admiring Mr. Mendoza's portraits of the mayor and the police chief, and saying dashing things to the girls. They, of course, walked in the opposite direction, followed closely by their unsympathetic aunts, which was only decent. Looking back, I wonder if perhaps saying those dashing things was better than making love. Mr. Mendoza wielded his paintbrush there for 30 years, I can still remember the old women muttering bad things about him on their way to market. This was nothing extraordinary. The old women muttered bad things about most of us at one time or another, especially when they were on their way to market at dawn. Double file, dark shawls pulled tight around their faces to buy pots of warm milk with the cow's hairs still floating in them. Not until later in the day, after their cups of coffee with a bit of this hairy milk strained through an old cloth and many spoonfuls of sugar, would they finally begin to concede the better points of the populace, except for Mr. Mendoza. Mr. Mendoza had taken the controversial position that he was the graffiti king of all Mexico. But we didn't want a graffiti king. My village is named El Rosario. Perhaps being named after a rosary was what gave us our sense of importance, a sense that we from Rosario were blessed among people, allowed certain dispensations. The name itself came from a Spanish monk, or was it a Spanish soldier, named Bonifacio Rojas, who broke his rosary. The beads cascaded over the ground. Kneeling to pick them up, he said a brief prayer, asking the good Lord to direct him to the beads. Like all good Catholics, he offered the Lord a deal. If you give me my beads back, I will give you a cathedral on the spot. The good Lord sent down St. Elmo's fire, and directly beneath that, the beads. Bonifacio got a taste of the Lord's wit, however, when he found an endless river of silver directly beneath the beads. It happened in 1655, the 3rd of August, a Saturday. The church was built, obliterating the ruins of an Indian settlement, and Rosario became the center of Chametla province. For some reason, the monks who followed Bonifacio took to burying each other in the cathedral's thick adobe walls. Some mysterious element in our soil mummifies monks, and they stood in the walls for 500 years. Now that the walls were crumbling, though, monks pop out with dry grins about once a year. When I was young, there was a 2-year lull in the gradual revelation of monks. We were certain that the hidden fathers had all been expelled from the walls. A thunderclap proved us wrong. Our rainy season begins on the 6th of June, without fail. That year, however, the rain was a day late, and the resulting thunderclap that announced the storm was so explosive, windows cracked on our street. Burros on the outskirts burst open their stalls and charged through town, throwing kicks right and left. People near the river swore their chickens laid square eggs. The immense frightfulness of this celestial apocalypse was blamed years afterward for gout, diarrhea, birthmarks, drunkenness, and those mysterious female aches nobody could define but everyone called dolencias. There was one other victim of the thunderclap. The remaining church tower split apart and dropped a fat slab of clay into the road. In the morning, my cousin Jaime and I were thrilled to find a mummified hand rising from the rubble, one saffron finger aimed at the sky. "An evangelist," I said.
"Even in death," he said.
We moved around the pile to see the rest of him. We were startled to find a message painted on the monk's chest. "How do you like me now? Deflated. Deflate your pomp or float away."
"Mr. Mendoza," I said. "He's everywhere," Jaime said.
On the road that runs north from Esquinapa to my village, there is a sign that says, "Rosario, population 8,000. Below that, in Mr. Mendoza's meticulous scrawl, "No intelligent life for 100 kilometers. There is a very tall bridge at the edge of town that spans the Baluarte River. My cousin Jaime told me that once a young man sat on the railing trading friendly insults with his friends. His sweetheart was a gentle girl from a nice family. She was wearing a white blouse that day. She ran up to give him a hug, but instead she knocked him from his perch, and he fell, arms and legs thrown open to the wind. They had to hold her back, or she would have joined him. He called her name all the way down, like a lost love letter spinning in the wind. No one ever found the body. They say she left town and married. She had 7 sons, and each one was named after her dead lover. Her husband left her. Near this fatal spot on the bridge, Mr. Mendoza suggested that we upend hypocrites today. Across town from the bridge, there is a gray whorehouse next to the cemetery. This allows the good citizens of the village to avoid the subjects of death and sex at the same time. On the wall facing the street, the message, "Turn your pride on its back and count its wiggly feet." On the stone wall that grows out of the cobble street in front of the cemetery, a new announcement appeared. Mendoza never slept here. What the hell did he mean by that? There was much debate in our bars over that one. Did Mr. Mendoza mean this literally? That he had never napped between the crumbling stones? Well, so what? Who would? No, others argued. He meant it philosophically, that Mr. Mendoza was claiming he'd never die. This was most infuriating. Police Chief Reyes wanted to know, who does Mr. Mendoza think he is? Mr. Mendoza, skulking outside the door, called in. I'll tell you, I'm Mendoza, that's who. But who or what are you? His feet could be heard trotting away in the dark. Mr. Mendoza never wrote obscenities. He was far too moral for that. In fact, he had been known to graffito malefactors as though they were road signs. Once, Mr. Mendoza's epochal paintbrush fell on me. Now, let's get back to our story. It was in the summer, in the month of August, Bonifacio's month. August is hot in Rosario, so hot that snapping turtles have been cooked by sitting in shallow water. Their green flesh turns gray and peels away to float down the eternal Baluarte. I always intended to follow the Baluarte downstream, for it carried hundreds of interesting items during flood times, and I was certain that somewhere farther down, there was a resting place for it all. The river seemed, at times, to be on a mad shopping spree, taking from the land anything it fancied. Mundane things, such as trees, chickens, cows, shot past regularly. But marvelous things floated there, too. A green De Soto, with its lights on. A washing machine with a religious statue in it as though the saint were piloting a circular boat. A blonde wig that looked like a giant squid. A mysterious star-shaped object barely visible under the surface. The Baluarte held me in its sway. I swam in it, fished, and caught turtles in it. I dreamed of the distant bend in the river where I could find all these floating things collected in neat stacks, and perhaps a galleon full of rubies, and perhaps a damp yet lovely 15-year-old girl in a red dress to rescue, and all of it speckled with little gray flecks of turtle skin. Sadly for me, I found out that the river only led to swamps that oozed out to the sea. All those treasures were lost forever, and I had to seek a new kind of magic from my river, which is precisely where Mr. Mendoza found me, on the banks of the post-magical Baluarte, lying in the mud with Jaime, gazing through a stand of reeds at some new magic. Girls. We had discovered girls, and a group of these recently discovered creatures was going from the preparatory school's sweltering rooms to the river for a bath. They had their spot, a shielded kink in the river that had a natural screen of trees and reeds and a sloping sandy bank. Jaime and I knew that we were about to make one of the greatest discoveries in recent history, and we'd be able to report to the men what we'd found out.
"Wait until they hear about this," I whispered. "It's a new world," he replied.
We inserted ourselves in the reeds, ignoring the mud soaking our knees. We could barely contain our longing and emotion. When the girls began to strip off their uniforms, revealing slips, then bright white bras and big cotton underpants, I thought I would sob.
"I can't," I said, "believe it. History in the making."
The bras came off. They dove in.
"Before us is everything we've always wanted," I said. "Life itself," he said. "Oh, you beautiful girls," I whispered. "Oh, you girls of my dreams," said he.
And Mr. Mendoza's claws sank into our shoulders. We were dragged 100 meters upriver, all the while being berated without mercy.
"Tartars," he shouted. "Peeping Toms, flesh chasers, disrespecters of privacy."
I would have laughed if I had not seen Mr. Mendoza's awful paintbrush standing in a freshly opened can of black paint.
"Uh-oh,"
I said.
"We're finished,"
said Jaime. Mr. Mendoza threw me down and sat on me. The man was skinny. He was bony, yet I could not buck him off. I bounced like one of those thunderstruck burros, and he rode me with aplomb. He attacked Jaime's face, painting, "I am filthy." He then peeled off Jaime's shirt and adorned his chest with, "I live for sex and thrills." He then yanked off Jaime's pants and decorated his rump with, "Kick me hard." I was next. On my face, "Pervert." On my chest, "Mother is blue with shame." On my rump, "This is what I am." I suddenly realized that the girls from the river had quickly dressed themselves and were giggling at me as I jumped around naked. It was unfair. Then, to make matters worse, Mr. Mendoza proceeded to chase us through town while people laughed at us and called out embarrassing weights and measures. We plotted our revenge for 2 weeks, then forgot about it. In fact, Jaime's "I live for sex" made him somewhat of a celebrity, that phrase being very macho. He was often known after that day as El Sexy. In fact, years later, he would marry one of the very girls we had been spying on. There was only one satisfaction for me in the whole sad affair: the utter disappearance of the street of my naked humiliation. Years after Bonifacio built his church in Rosario, and after he had died and was safely tucked away in the church walls, until 1958, when he fell out on my Uncle Jorge, the mines got established as a going concern. Each vein of silver seemed to lead to another. The whole area was a network of ore-bearing arteries. Tunnels were dug and forgotten as each vein played out and forked off. Often, miners would break through a wall of rock only to find themselves in an abandoned mine shaft going in the other direction. Sometimes they'd find skeletons. Once, they swore they'd encountered a giant spider that caught bats in its vast web. Many of these mine shafts filled with seepage from the river, forming underground lagoons that had fat white frogs in them and an albino alligator that floated in the dark water waiting for helpless miners to stumble and fall in. Some of these tunnels snaked under the village. At times, with a whoomp, sections of Rosario vanished. Happily, I watched the street Mr. Mendoza had chased me down drop from sight after a quick shudder. A store and six houses dropped as one. I was particularly glad to see Antonia Barrego vanish with a startled look while sitting on her porch yelling insults at me. Her voice rose to a horrified screech that echoed loudly underground as she went down. When she was finally pulled out by block and tackle, the sow, she was all wrinkled from the smelly water, and her hair was alive with squirming white polywogs. After the street vanished, my view of El Yauco was clear and unobstructed. El Yauco is the mountain that stands across the Baluarte from Rosario. The top of it looks like the profile of John F. Kennedy in repose. Only flaw in this geographic wonder is that the nose is upside down. Once, when Jaime and I had painfully struggled to the summit to investigate the nose, we found this message. Mother Nature has no respect for Yankee presidents either. Nothing, though, could prepare us for the furor over his next series of messages. It began with a piglet running through town one Sunday. On its flanks, in perfect cursive script, Mendoza goes to heaven on Tuesday. On a fence, Mendoza escapes this hellhole. On my father's car, I've had enough. I'm leaving. Rumors flew. For some reason, the arguments were fierce, impassioned, and there were any number of fistfights over Mr. Mendoza's latest. Was he going to kill himself? Was he dying? Was he to be abducted by flying saucers or carried aloft by angels? The people who were convinced the old Mendoza never slept here was a strictly philosophical text were convinced he was indeed going to commit suicide. There was a secret that showed in their faces. They were actually hoping he'd kill himself just to maintain the status quo, just to ensure that everyone died. Rumors about Mendoza's health washed through town. Cancer. Madness. Well, we all knew that. Demonic possession. The evil eye. A black magic curse that included love potions and slow-acting poisons. And the dreaded syphilis. Some of the local smart alecks called the whorehouse heaven, but Mr. Mendoza was far too moral to even go in there, much less advertise it all over town. I worked in Crispin's bar, taking orders and carrying trays of beer bottles. I heard every theory. The syphilis one really appealed to me because young fellows always love the gruesome and lurid, and it sounded so nasty, having to do, as it did, with the nether regions.
Syphilis makes it fall off,
Jaime explained. I didn't want him to know I wasn't sure which it fell off, if it was it or some other it. To be macho, you must already know everything, know it so well that you're already bored by the knowledge.
Yes,
I said wearily.
It certainly does.
Right off, he marveled.
To the street,
I concluded. Well, that very night, that night of heavenly theories, Mr. Mendoza came into the bar. The men stopped all their arguing and immediately taunted him.
Oh, look, Saint Mendoza is here.
Hey, Mendoza, seen any angels lately?
He only smirked. Then, squaring his slender shoulders, he walked, erect, to the bar.
Boy,
he said to me,
a beer.
As I handed him the bottle, I wanted to confess, I will change my ways. I will never peep at girls again. He turned and faced the crowd and gulped down his beer, emptying the entire bottle without coming up for air. When the last of the foam ran from its mouth, he slammed the bottle on the counter and said, ah. Then he belched, loudly. This greatly offended the gathered men, and they admonished him. But he ignored them, crying out,
what do you think of that, huh? The belch is the cry of the water buffalo, the hog. I give it to you because it is the only philosophy you can understand.
More offended still, the crowd began to mumble. Mr. Mendoza turned to me and said,
I see there are many wiggly feet present. The man's insane,
said Crispin. Mr. Mendoza continued,
social change and the nipping at complacent buttocks was my calling on earth. Who among you can deny that I and my brush are a perfect marriage? Who among you can hope to do more with a brush than I?
He pulled the brush from under his coat. Several men shied away.
I tell you now, he said, here is the key to heaven.
He nodded to me once and strode toward the door. Just before he passed into the night, he said,
my work is finished.
Now, let's get back to our story. Tuesday morning, we were up at dawn. Jaime had discovered a chink in Fat Antonia's new roof. Through it, we could look down into her bedroom. We watched her dress. She moved in billows like a meaty rain cloud. In a way, I whispered, it has its charm.
A bountiful harvest,
Jaime said condescendingly. After this ritual, we climbed down to the street. We heard the voices, saw people heading for the town square. Suddenly, we remembered,
today!
We cried in unison. The ever-growing throng was following Mr. Mendoza. His startling shock of white hair was bright against his dark skin. He wore a dusty black suit, his funeral suit. He walked into a corner of the square, knelt down, and pried the lid off a fresh can of paint. He produced the paintbrush with a flourish and held it up for all to see. There was an appreciative mumble from the crowd, a smattering of applause. He turned to the can, dipped the brush in the paint. There was a hush. Mr. Mendoza painted a black swirl on the flagstones. He went around and around with the legendary paintbrush, filling in the swirl until it was a solid black O. Then, with a grin, with a virtuoso's mastery, he jerked his brush straight up, leaving a solid, glistening pole of wet paint standing in the air. We gasped. We clapped. Mr. Mendoza painted a horizontal line connected to the first at a 90-degree angle. We cheered. We whistled. He painted up, across, up, across, until he was reaching over his head. It was obvious soon enough. We applauded again, this time with feeling. Mr. Mendoza turned to look at us and waved once. Whether in farewell or terse dismissal, we'll never know. Then, raised one foot and placed it on the first horizontal.
No, we said,
He stepped up. Fat Antonia fainted. The boys all tried to look up her dress when she fell, but Jaime and I were very macho because we'd seen it already. Still, Mr. Mendoza rose. He painted his way up, the angle of the stairway carrying him out of the plazuela and across town, over Bonifacio's crumbling church, over the cemetery where he had never slept and would apparently never sleep. Crispin did good business selling beers to the crowd. Mr. Mendoza, now small as a high-flying crow, climbed higher over the baluarte and its deadly bridge, over El Yauco and Kennedy's inverted nose, almost out of sight. The stairway wavered like smoke in the breeze. People were getting bored, and they began to wander off, back to work, back to the rumors. That evening, Jaime and I went back to Fat Antonia's roof. It happened on June 5th of that year. That night, at midnight, the rains came. By morning, the paint had washed away. Beautiful story, yeah. You know, I've read, as I said at the beginning, I've read this author before, and what I love about his writing is his proficiency, his brilliance, really, at making me as a reader feel the reality of the setting and the characters. I mean, I believed the boys and their quest to look at naked girls. He gets humanity and has a way of encapsulating in his writing the very stuff that we are made of. A couple of other things. There is at the beginning a paragraph that goes, "The beads cascaded over the ground. Kneeling to pick them up, he said a brief prayer, asking the good Lord to direct him to the beads. Like all good Catholics, he offered the Lord a deal. If you give me my beads back, I will give you a cathedral on the spot." Now, my mother, and I've talked about my mom, Irma Jean, numerous times on the podcast. She was not born or raised in a Catholic tradition, as I was. She was raised more in a Black Baptist context of religion. The reason my sisters and I were educated in Catholic schools was for the education. My mother wanted to give us the best opportunity to reach our highest potential, and she believed that to be through as good an education as she could provide for us. Now, what's really fascinating to me is that later in her life, I mean, maybe in her 70s, my mother converted to Catholicism and went to Mass and confession. And my sister Letitia and I, who's 5 years older, we speculate that she, in fact, had made some kind of deal with God. And I can only imagine that it was something along the lines of, if you allow me, this single woman, to raise my 3 Black children safely in this country, which is to say they aren't, you know, beset by drugs or police extrajudicial, you know, shootings, that if I am able to successfully raise my children the way my dreams would prefer, that I will
give my soul to you. And as practical as a woman as my mother is, I can really believe that that was her pact with God. Of course, I'll never know, but that is my belief, as well as my sister Letitia's. The other thing that occurs to me is Mr. Mendoza's exit. And Mr. Mendoza's final gesture was not just grandiose, it was miraculous. He was a master at what he did, and he was able to use his mastery to create a spectacular exit. None of us are really that lucky, nor are most of us that conscious of how we're going to go out. I mean, but the real interesting thing to me is that we do have major influence on how we are remembered, right? And we are remembered for not just what we did, but who we are, right? How we behaved in the service of living our lives. And, you know, sometimes I'm asked in interviews, how do you, LeVar, want to be remembered? And, you know, I struggle with that question. Because there are, I guess at this point in my life, I figure there are more than a few ways that I could answer that question. But when really, you know, searching my soul for the truth of the answer to that question, I always come back to some version of, I wanted kids to read, or I wanted people to read, especially children. It's an interesting thing to contemplate that we actually have influence on how we get remembered. In fact, our whole lives lead up to the resolution of that question. How will you be remembered? And it is our daily thoughts, our daily words, our daily deeds that all add up to that remembering, what people will say about the lives we lived while we were here. My great thanks to Luis Alberto Urrea for allowing me to read his story today. You can find it in his collection entitled The Water Museum. And he's got a new novel out which made lots of the best of lists in 2023. It's called Good Night, Irene. Check it out, y'all. Our producer on this episode of LeVar Burton Reads is Julia Smith. She is the best in the business, y'all. Our fabulous researcher is L.D. Lewis. Always happy to have you aboard, my sister. We had additional research support this season from Talon Stradley and Josephine Martirana. Theme music by the extraordinary Brendan Burns. Editing and sound design courtesy of the fantastic Jared O'Connell. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend about it or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Like I say, share the short fiction wealth. LeVar Burton Reads is a production of Stitcher and LeVar Burton Entertainment. Our executive producers are Josephine Martirana and yours truly, LeVar Burton. And if you want to find me on the internet, I'm LeVar.Burton on Instagram, at LeVar Burton on X, or you can simply go to LeVarBurton.com. You can also join my book club at fable.co/LeVar. I'll see you next time, but you don't have to take my word for it. Stitcher.